Good evening. James McKenney here with my Science Hour, February 9th, 2017. Many topics to cover tonight. A little bit of wrap-up on election results. The Comet Earth update, the little comet that's up there. We've had some strange weather, but remember, February is like August in that it is the opposite side of the year is August, and it tends to be one of the more vile weather months of the year, oddly enough. We think of the January thaw, and every month seems to have its weather peculiarities. But there are more tornadoes in February than any other month. It's kind of a strange statistic, something that possibly a lot of people are not aware of. But I don't know if it's the most, but it ranks up there relative to tornadoes, and we just had some in New Orleans. And so that the opposite side of the solar system from the return current sheet, which very likely is related to the electrical current that comes into the sun from the outer regions of the solar system. It's not what ignites the sun. It's just the one of the factors, because the sun acts as a plasma discharge comet in the galactic capacitor. That's the same process that the sun uses, or that Saturn and Jupiter use to create their capacitors. There is a beta release on the wing generator, and that's very exciting news. I'll be talking about that. Guest appearances. I was on the John Wells Show, John B. Wells Caravan to Midnight, last Thursday night, February 2nd. So check that out. Go to Caravan to Midnight, T-O, Midnight, not the number two, but Caravan to Midnight, John B. Wells. And I've been a guest on that show many times. Joyce Riley this yesterday morning, 8 o'clock. And Daniel interviewing. Joyce was coming on the third hour. But a very interesting interview, I believe. Go listen to that. And then, of course, John Moore, every Wednesday morning. I'm on the Joyce Riley Show every Wednesday morning. It's the every second Wednesday of the month. And so yesterday was the second Wednesday of the month, so I'm on at 8 o'clock. Typically, I'm on the John Moore Show at 8 o'clock every Wednesday. But on the second Wednesday, I flip and do the 9 o'clock John Moore Show at 9 o'clock Central Time. These are all Central Time. Anyway, on to the main science topic, the comet and severe weather. Now, the factors involved in, we've seen two hurricanes in the Atlantic, far north in the North Atlantic, coming off of Nova Scotia and moving up northwards to Iceland. So you literally could call them hurricanes. And so that occurred, then the tornadoes in New Orleans, in Louisiana. And here's what I wanted to announce about the comet effect. And this, remember, I announced between January 29th to February 4th, which does not account for the hurricanes in the North Atlantic nor the Louisiana tornadoes. But something very interesting happened. Now, let's look at what Earth is doing right now. Because of the Earth's tilt, 23.5 degrees, the south solar region, the south polar region, is pointed towards the sun. So it's summertime in Antarctica. And so moving into what you might call fall in Antarctica, but still very much summertime. And what happened when this comet came and did its electrical alignment, remember, it is on the sunward side. And so that puts us on the tail side of the comet. The jet stream, the southern jet stream, moved almost down to the Arctic Circle. And typically, it's moving through, around Argentina and Chile, somewhere up higher latitude. But the jet stream literally went down and moved around the Arctic Circle. And so very strange behavior. And all of the weather patterns across Africa and South America moved south. And so that's something I'm going to be studying in the future. I don't know specifically that that was due to the comet, but it was a strange phenomena I had not seen before. That doesn't mean it never happened before, because many times I'm busy. I wish I had more time to study weather on a daily basis, but due to all the other things going on in my life, I haven't really been able to study that in detail. So that would be if I had a fleet of graduate students and had the James McCanney University, that's something I would definitely have some graduate student researching for possibly a PhD thesis or at least a high-level paper, publishable paper. The CNN is still pumping out New World Order United Nations Agenda 21, stating yesterday, I saw this CNN announcement, that they claim it's the hottest year on record. And they're going for the broke because they're being tossed out of Washington. It's about time. John Bates was in NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, what we call the National Weather Service, and is basically stating that they fixed data right before the Paris Climate Change Summit to promote the idea of climate change, get the carbon tax, all those other things in there, which Obama was trying to do, Clinton would have done if she would have been elected, which is killing Canada. I mean, I know people in Canada, and they're just hurting. They've got increased taxes. This carbon tax is just absolutely slaughtering the businesses there. And luckily, we got Trump in there, and he's getting rid of the climate change baloney, basically draining that Washington swamp, which is... Now, I started opposing the global climate change baloney back in even before the 1990s. And it was started really by Carl Sagan, of all people. And just a little side note, remember I started my Cosmos series in the paid cast, began last week. This week is the first actual episode of the Cosmos series, so go to the paid cast at my webpage. But Carl Sagan was a champion for what is known as the greenhouse effect. And so this is where allegedly Venus, the planet, got its very high temperature. Now, here's the story. There was no mention, there was no talk of greenhouse effect ever before that. But Velikovsky had predicted that Venus should have a very high temperature, certainly abnormal. And I remember when the NASA scientists, were expecting Venus to have dinosaurs and, you know, possibly people walking around. They really didn't know, but they expected it to be a very Earth-like environment. It's closer to the sun, but they knew also from radio telescope data that it did not rotate like Earth every 24 hours. Venus is like every 106 days or something. So it rotates very slowly. But they'd never expected a very high temperature. The Russians had told them, hey, it's boiling hot there. It's really, really hot. And they didn't believe Russia. They never believed Russia. Then they got there, landed, realized that the temperature of Venus, the surface temperature, was hot enough to melt lead that was raining at sulfur dioxide raining out of the sky instead of water, certainly not in exactly the kind of environment you would expect dinosaurs to be roaming around. So they had to come up with a reason for this high temperature on Venus. So they came up with in fact, Carl Sagan spearheaded this because he was the one who spearheaded the drive against Velikovsky. And so they had to come up with a reason that was scientifically compatible with all the other baloney they were trying to pawn off on the public. So they came up with the greenhouse effect. Well, it didn't take long in the peer review system. Scientists came out and said, hey, the greenhouse effect doesn't work. So Sagan comes out literally with the exaggerated greenhouse effect. That's literally what they called it. It's like, well, let's put in some Schwann's factors here. A Schwann's factor is a term we used in college when students would come in and try and cheat on a test, on a physics test, for example, or in a laboratory, especially in a laboratory. They'd come in, they knew what the results were supposed to be. They had some data that they had taken in the laboratory, and they really didn't know how to make the two mesh. So they went along and they kind of worked backwards from the answers they knew they were supposed to get. They worked forward from the data that they had taken, and somewhere in the middle, there was a magical factor that got placed in. We called it the Schwann's factor, and it was a factor that made the front and the back end of the experiment match. And so it was always comical to see that, but when you see it in real science, so when they called it the exaggerated greenhouse effect, well, you knew the fix was on. And of course, they get their information directly from God, therefore they can never be wrong. And so one other thing that's going on in the climate change world is that scientists are going to make a protest. Well, you know, what they're protesting is they're not going to get a paycheck. That's what they're protesting. They even in this CNN posting, the Candy Nugget News, said that the wildfires in Canada were more extreme due to global climate change. Well, no. It's called the government burning down the forest so they can extract uranium ore from that region in Alberta, Saskatchewan, and forcing the people off the land. So they, and that's what they did, is they burned it down with a fire, a man-made controlled fire. And so these clowns come along, the climate change people, and say, oh, the fire was there because of climate change. Oh, man, I'll tell you, you better have some serious hip boots these days if you go around the scientific or the mainstream media, news media. The ban on travel, just a quick note, 1952, the McCarran-Walter Act, signed into law by Harry Truman, passed by Congress, basically allows the president nearly unlimited power to limit immigration when the president sees fit for obviously reasons of national security. Jimmy Carter made use of it. It was 1979. The Iranian crisis was going on. And Jimmy Carter made all Iranians register. They had to report in. He deported 15,000 of them. So this is nothing new. Bill Clinton used the McCarran-Walter Act in his presidency to limit immigration. So what's the big deal? And by the way, both of those guys were Democrats. So interesting. Once again, it's called the McCarran, McCarran, McCarran-Walter Act of 1952. And the interesting part about that is with Jimmy Carter, these were people who had visas. They were legal visas, and they still had to report in. And they found out that many of them had overextended their stays or violated the conditions of their visa, so they were deported. But these are people that had visas. They were not illegal aliens. They actually had legitimate visas, and they were deported. So this has been used before and by Democrats. So come on, people, learn history, please, before you start jumping up and down and making noise. A little bit of a Planet X update. I had another call from a concerned listener the other yesterday, asking about Planet X, and somebody has been using the Bible to predict Planet X coming in, you know, some date in the near future. And it's the same story. How many thousands of these do we have to wade through before people get a clue that there's no story? There's nothing to this. There's no information, and if people do have information, there's a way that they have to present it with actual astronomical data. because the Earth is spinning through space, and it's a dot of dust out here. And, you know, for something to come in and be close enough to where it would actually interact with Earth is highly, highly unlikely. And, of course, it's happened in the past. Certainly not impossible, but at any given moment, it's highly unlikely. So if you are alleging some kind of interaction, you better have some pretty good data, and none of these people do. It's just one claim after the other. You know, oh, somebody's got a picture of it. Well, pictures don't cut it either. You need data, orbital data, and it's not that difficult. If you're actually seeing something, then you take pictures on successive nights, get an orbital determination, and there's a standard format to put this in. It's not rocket science. You know, thousands, tens of thousands of amateur astronomers know how to do this. So this is not rocket science of, you know, ultra difficult science. Okay, on to the next topic. Just a quick review on the election. Now, my white paper I released during my January 19th paid cast. You can see that, join the paid cast, it's there. And I did a summary November 3rd, my commercial-free show. I released a statement about 10 methods used for cheating in an election. We added one since then, knowing that they were actually making false reports from precincts, actually writing down and increasing the number for Hillary Clinton. But I talked quite a bit about this on the Joyce Riley show yesterday. But I just wanted to summarize something. That the whole purpose of this is to, number one, identify the cheating centers so that a real analysis can be made, and the end result is they have to re-register voters in all of these centers, and that's something that's very important. And this is something that easily can be done prior to the next election. We have 4 years till the next presidential election. There's no excuse like, oh, grandmas cannot get out to register to vote. No, this is the cause of massive voter fraud, the registration rolls. That's just one method that's being used. We have to go back to paper ballots, people being verified in a precinct and verifying that they're not registered in five different places, or walk-ins, that type of thing. No, and we don't need a national ID. You don't need chips put in your body. You don't need a picture ID or any of that. This is easily done because these are local precincts. It's just that that's one of the things that has to be done to cure the 11 different ways that were used to cheat. And, of course, get rid of voting machines. I mean, when you go to an airport and you go up to a candy or a pop machine or something, you put your money in and you go, oh, E3, that's the candy bar you want or whatever. If something else fell out, you'd go, what a stupid machine. How can they put this here? You would never expect it, and really, it wouldn't happen. But if you go up to the voting machine to vote for president of the United States and you put in your vote and you pull the lever and something else comes up, wow, I mean, that's a problem. That's a real problem. And that's not trackable. There's no way to track that after it's happened. So we don't even know how bad the cheating was. But I know that my four different methods of calculating mathematical regression analysis show that Hillary Clinton had no more than 50 million votes. I now believe she could have gotten as few as 30 million votes in the election, which would have given Trump an even bigger landslide victory. So there's two issues. One is to identify the cheating centers and shut them so that they cannot cheat anymore, so that they run fair elections there, and then to prevent it from happening in the future. And there are people out there trying to stop the Electoral College. The Electoral College is very necessary. It's a very intelligent way to work things. And if it weren't for the Electoral College, we would have a president that wasn't elected. that won by cheating, the stuffing the ballot box. And that's what the Electoral College, one of the reasons it was put in place, to stop large population centers from controlling the popular vote. Okay, so at any rate, just wanted to summarize that. I hope that study gets a lot more recognition because it's very important. I believe it's, from everything I've seen, it's by far the most comprehensive study of any. And by the way, that appeared on my January 19th podcast. That's where the summary of all of that work is. Cybersecurity update. One of the main things on Trump's plate is bringing back cybersecurity to the government, to business, and to you. And in 2007, I had worked in the secure computing industry for a long time, and a lot of people didn't know that about me. Now I'm out of there. I'm not working in that anymore, so I made that public. But for 25 years of my life, I worked as a high-level engineer in the telecommunications industry and cybersecurity. And it's one of my specialties. And in 2007, I broke the RSA codes. These are the encryption security codes for firewalls and transmission that used prime numbers. And I did that by creating a method of calculating directly prime numbers, not one at a time, but in groups. And so in 2014, I followed that up with another book called Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, which literally showed anybody how to break the RSA codes. The trouble is that the NSA knew all about that. They forced computer security companies to continue using RSA codes, and that's part of the cause, one of the causes, one of the main causes of horrible security in the United States, because other countries realized this and went to other forms of security. But because of the NSA demanding the ability to snoop into your computer, if companies went out and sold you real cybersecurity, then the NSA would have to retool, and it would be a lot harder for them to get into your computer. So they're forcing companies to continue to sell broken security software. So that's one of the big problems. Once again, I hope to get that in front of the correct people so that problem can be solved and we can get back to secure computing. For 10 years of my 25 years, I worked in a company where we sold IBM-compatible front-end processors. Those are the computers that offloaded the IBM mainframes of the telecommunication function. And we had encryption and encoding and everything like that. But I'll tell you something, we never, ever had a case of hacking. It simply didn't happen. It did not happen. And so it can be done, but by people that know what they're doing. And Trump, I heard him say it. He's a very aware guy. He said, we've got people in charge of this who don't know what they're doing. And man, talk about hit the nail on the head. The people in government security, but they hire stupid people. It's called, there's a reason for that. They want people in there. It's like tier two science. They want people there who don't know anything. They're easily manipulated, and they will say anything. Climate change, comets are dirty snowballs. Yeah, they'll say whatever it takes to get that paycheck. My new release for the NASCA lines is out there and rolling. There's three ways to get it. You can get it by simply buying the NASCA release. The button is on my sales page. You can get it if you buy more than $100 of product from the sales page. And of course, if you buy more than $300, you not only get the NASCA paper, but you get all of the prior months of my paid cast, including the current month, for free. And then, of course, you have to join, subscribe for future months starting in March. But at any rate, that's one of the ways to get the NASCA lines paper. My new release is in addition to the, December 31st, 2015 release of part one, where I showed that the NASCA lines, exactly what they're all about. Part two his more recent discoveries, and there will be some other addendums coming out in the future. I don't have a specific date right now. Just a quick update here on the wing generator. We have a beta model which is ready for release, and we're going to start selling it. So a beta test is, in the engineering industry, what it says is we have a model that has gone through testing, and we've verified to our own liking that it works well. But now we're going to set it out where the public can have access to it. And it's not as large as the 12-meter that I had originally planned. It's smaller, but I simply didn't have enough money to do the 12-meter. That's a big, big project. But that would lead nicely into the much bigger models that would eventually replace nuclear and coal power plants. But this first model is going to get us up and running. It's a proof of concept, which means we have proven the wing generator concept. We have proven it. It works. It's an excellent design, and it's going to take over the energy industry. I'm very happy with the way I presented this, because the people that I've been working with are very good. They have knowledge about things that I'm not that good at, and I have knowledge about the basic design that they're not so good at. So at any rate, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, for more information. But I'm very pleased with this. Finally, we're getting a model out for the general public to use, or businesses, or whoever, and there's the specifications and details you'll find on my webpage. I'm not sure if it's there at the time of the airing of this show, but it should be. But make sure you go there, because we have the information to put up, and then all of the details will be there, how to procure them. And I know there's some pent-up interest in this, quite a bit of pent-up interest, so I encourage people to go there and check this out. I am extremely happy about this. It's moving forward, and my goal is within a couple of years to have much larger models on the market available for ranches and small industry, etc., eco-villages, small villages that are remote, and then grow from there. And I'm just very happy with that. It's been a long time in coming, but it's finally here. So once again, the beta product on the wing generator hitting the streets. Hopefully you will be part of this. And all of the terms and conditions are on my webpage. Just a quick update on Fukushima. This is, it's scary to even have to announce this, but Fukushima has basically gone China syndrome. The core has melted. It's down into the water table. It's polluting the water table and into the ocean. The radiation is now being detected in the west coast of the United States. All of the government naysayers, those who claim that the death of the Pacific Ocean was due to green algae or something, I hope these people end up in prison someday. And we need to, I mean, this is just beyond apocalyptic, to have a nuclear reactor at Fukushima or any place that has gone basically China syndrome. I don't even know what to say as a scientist, as a nuclear physicist, to imagine that the nuclear nightmare is upon us. That's all I can say. It's just horrific, and it could have been prevented. Obama did nothing, as he did with everything else. Doing nothing is actually negative, because if you can't, there's a picture of these little ducks, and the one in front is kind of tripping. They say if you can't lead, then you have to follow. And that's the case with Obama. He just did so much damage to this planet, partly because he was a minion of the New World Order bankers, and secondly because he was just a complete idiot. How could you take a guy with his background and try and have him run the largest country, most powerful country on the planet? Yeah, excuse me, it doesn't work. On to the next science topic, and this is a very important point.
I want to discuss my paid cast just a little bit. This week is part one, the first in the series of Cosmos. Last week was the introduction in the paid cast. And these are very important. The paid cast for tonight is, I'll include extensive science regarding what I call the axioms of astronomy. And within that, I talk about my theoretical work called the induced electric dipole redshift. Now, that may sound a bit complicated to certain people, but tonight I want to take and introduce a concept that's extremely important both in gravity, both in electromagnetism, and in magnetism. And this is the type of forces that change with spatial coordinates. In other words, if you're in a certain place, you have a certain force or reactivity to the gravity or the magnetism or electromagnetic forces or whatever, and they change depending on where you are. And so this is very important, but the simplest type of force of this type we call a 1 over r squared force, which means that if you're twice as far away, it has 1/4 the effect. If you're 3 times as far away, it has 1/9 the effect. If you're 4 times away, it has 1/16 the effect. And this is true for electrical charges in outer space or in an atomic world, or gravity works the same way. So it really is a measure of space, not so much the consideration, whether it's gravity or electric charge. It's a spatial issue, and it has to do with the energy that is available for some object to be changed at a given distance. And so, at any rate, I want to explain this a little bit because it's instrumental in my concept, the induced electric dipole redshift. And if you are in the paid cast, you'll see that also I provide a lot of visual effects and the photos, etc., that accompany each lecture. Now, a lot of people watch YouTube videos, and the problem with YouTube videos, number one, it's a shark's den of misinformation, and they, for some reason, really don't like me over there. When people post something favorable about me on a YouTube video, it's immediately erased. So, somewhat of a taboo. They post things there that aren't true about me. People will take, I think the CIA did this starting in 2012, they take pieces of my voice from past radio shows, put them together, put them with weird music, and then put it on the internet claiming that I'm saying that, for example, Planet X is something or another, imminent disaster, and it's not me at all. It's a cut-and-paste job of my voice making it sound like I've said something. And I've even had listeners go back, and they've actually found the shows where the clips came from, some as early as 2002 or 2004. So I don't like YouTube for that reason. And secondly, a lot of the videos that you see there have slides that are posted, and it's a very poor use of video. They don't really have good content. And so what I try and do with my paid cast is I put still pictures with more commentary, typed commentary, and that provides me with a control over my material, so it can't be robbed and taken and cut and pasted. And then it also allows me to generate exactly the material I want. And as I say, if you're just putting up slides or something like that or drawings, then YouTube videos are really a waste of bandwidth and your time to sit there and look and watch as... you can typically read a lot faster than you can listen to a video. So you get more information the way I'm presenting it in the paid cast. But okay, back to the topic of, it's called the 1 over r squared forces. And this comes into play. It's very interesting because let's just take gravity, for example. Gravity is always attractive. So if you have a mass and another mass, they always attract each other. And here's an interesting thing, that if you have a bigger mass, you would think that a force on a given mass would increase and it would move faster because there's more force because the mass is bigger. But as it turns out, it's harder to move that mass in proportion to its mass. And therefore, what Galileo found out by experimentation was that if you go up to the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa and you drop two balls, one a great big massive ball and another small but a massive ball for its size, they will hit the ground at the same time. Now, this was the beginning of experimentation in the scientific world, something that's been totally lost. Now, science and space science and astronomy is done by, it's agreed upon by convention or by vote, popular vote. What's more popular? Is it the Big Bang this week? Or is it that comets are dirty snowballs? If more scientists vote for that, or climate change, does that make it true? No. And the scientific method says that you define experiments that in the experimental data, it proves the concept. And it would be clear to you or me or somebody in Russia or somebody that just came in from another solar system. The experimental method, the scientific method, you define an experiment and then somebody might come along and say, hey, but your experiment doesn't account for such and such. Oh, gee, okay, well now we got to look at that. So science is something that is modified continually. And you can always expect surprises. And so when, for example, people agree on the Big Bang, there's a lot of people who don't agree, but in the political world of science, agreement of rank and file scientists seems to carry more weight than experimentation. But what if the redshifts that they observe coming from stars and quasars and galaxies really doesn't have anything to do with its motion or their place in the universe or the Hubble constant, which translates the redshift into a distance for distant galaxies, etc. What if none of that were true? And I'll be talking in the future also about the blind map maker, something that is very important to understand, that if you're making a map of the universe based on false information, in other words, the redshift, then your map of the universe is going to be incorrect. And all of the theories that result from that will equally be incorrect. But, okay, so let's take two masses of equal size, and I'm going to describe it. This is a undergraduate physics experiment that is performed, and it's called the Cavendish balance, a very ingenious device because gravitational forces are very weak. So how do you measure gravitational forces on something in a laboratory and determine, for example, the capital G, the constant of gravity? How do you determine this in a laboratory? Well, if you take a wire, a thin wire, and so from that you suspend a bar, and at the end of the bar you have two weights. Okay, those weights balance. And now the wire that's suspending all of this, if you turn those weights just ever so slightly, that's going to cause the wire to spin and shorten by just ever so little. So the force on the two balls at the end of the rod that's suspended is measurable. So now let's take another equally massive ball that's on a little post that's stationary, and we move that near the two balls that are suspended. And with this very simple experiment, you can measure the very weak force of gravity. And so we can understand items like the gravitational constant, other properties, and you can also do this for electricity. There's ways of measuring, for example, the charge on an electron. It's a very simple experiment in which you take in oil drops. And this is something we actually built these experiments when I was in college. We had a shop. We had a technician in the shop, Brother Finbar, and he took these experiments and per our design built them, and we had the experiment. So the measuring the charge on an electron is an experiment where you take and you have oil drops that are extremely fine, extremely small, in between a parallel plate capacitor, and the charge is sufficient to cause that oil drop to levitate. And you can actually measure the charge, the basic charge on an electron with this experiment. And it gets a little bit more complicated than that because you don't always have a single charge on an oil drop. You might have two or three or four or one. But the way the experiment is set up, you measure the charge on the electron. So at any rate, given a gravitational mass, a ball, or the Earth, or a star, or a galactic nucleus, you can then talk about the gravitational field and the fact that it changes with distance. Now, this is the important issue. If, like I say, if you're twice as far away, then there will be 1/4 of the force. In other words, 1 over r squared. So 2 squared is 4. 1 divided by 4 is 1/4. If you're 3 times as far away, it's 3 squared is 9, 1/9 the force. If you're 4 times away, 4 squared is 16. It's 1/16 the force, etc. So you square the distance and then divide by that number, and that gives you the proportionality of the gravitational or electrical force. But now in the world of electricity, let's imagine a little piece of metal, little teeny piece of metal. And in outer space, you have a comet nucleus, which is electrically charged. So we're within the shielding region of the comet nucleus. We can sense the electric charge of the nucleus. And there's a piece of metal. It doesn't have a charge. It's neutral. It has as many electrons in the piece of metal as protons, and therefore, to all respects and visibility and measurements, there's no force at all on that piece of metal. However, something interesting happens in metals. They're conductors, and the electrons are free to move around. So the electrons are going to try and move away from that negatively charged comet nucleus, leaving the closer side positive. Now, understanding that we're in a non-uniform electric field, these positive charge that's closer to the nucleus of the comet is going to be pulled slightly more than the far side, which where the electrons are populating. It's going to push away on that side because negative charges repel each other, but it's going to push away with just a little bit less force than the protons that are closer because the protons are closer. It's a 1 over r squared. It's a non-uniform electric field. This gives rise to a very subtle concept in physics called the induced electric dipole force. But what I did is I applied this to electromagnetism because when an X-ray or a gamma ray comes in close to an atomic nucleus, which is charged, it's a positive charge, but it's a non-uniform charge. It's shielded by the electron, so outside that electron shielding, the visible charge, the measurable charge on that atom is zero. But if you get inside that electron cloud and in close to the nucleus, all of a sudden you have an extremely powerful non-uniform electric field, and the photon contains two charges, a positive and a negative charge. And this was the result of me realizing that when that high-energy photon comes into a nucleus of an atom, it splits into a positron and an electron. The positron and electron, the masses and the antimatter in the proton of the positron, the matter of the electron, were created by a process, we call it E equals MC squared. It's the Einstein result from special relativity, the conversion of energy into mass and matter into energy. It can go back and forth. And so anyway, you create these two particles, and the energy has to add up. If there's extra energy in the photon, it goes into the velocity of these two particles. But where did the charge come from? You've got a negative and a positive charge, so they must have been contained in the photon of light, and therefore a photon will experience the induced electric dipole force just like our little piece of metal does in a comet nucleus or in the vicinity of a charged comet nucleus. And so I speculated that comets would produce redshifts. In around 1986, a group of scientists with spectroscopy equipment went to South America to take the spectrum with telescopes, etc., of Halley's Comet. And they were there to do basic research. When they came back, they noticed that all of the light had redshifts. And the closer you got to the nucleus of the comet, the more the redshift. Proving my work conclusively, but you know what? They didn't publish it. They didn't publish the data because they didn't know what caused it. And of course, they were not allowed to publish the data because it would have blown the Big Bang theory and everything else out of the water. Because now the redshift that would come from quasars, from galaxies, supposedly moving away from us, was not due to the motion. It was due to the induced electric dipole redshift. And the interesting thing is you can take the induced electric dipole redshift and prove it in a laboratory. You can prove, number one, that it causes a redshift. Number two, you can show that it causes a bending of light. And this is the important part in my paid cast for this week, is that this is in my books, this is in my work, in my published papers, etc. But I don't have time in the paid cast to go through all of these scientific details, so I'm more or less coordinating the two. So when you listen to this lecture, you're going to understand a little bit better what I'm talking about in the paid cast of this week when I talk about the induced electric dipole redshift. So the photons of light, whether they're microwaves, infrared light, visible light, ultraviolet light, X-rays, gamma rays, no matter what the electromagnetic radiation, then it is subject to redshifting. In fact, I have a story that I tell about the Voyager spacecraft. As they approached Jupiter, the microwave oscillator, it's called a Marconi oscillator, that was on board the Voyager spacecraft, and that's what provides the very stable frequency signal that's used to transmit data from the spacecraft to Earth and back and forth. It's a very set frequency, and that's how you pull data out of a very noisy outer space environment where there's tremendous amount of electromagnetic noise, etc. You lock on to a specific frequency, and it's called phase locking, and you lock onto that frequency, and then you can transmit data. But when the Voyager spacecraft got to Jupiter, the Marconi oscillator frequency, which we know is extremely stable, dipped to the red. And then as it passed beyond Jupiter, it blue shifted and then came back to normal. And what is this telling us? That's the scientists, when I was at Cornell, this data came in. I was sitting in the meeting watching it, and I'm going, this is verification of my induced electric dipole redshift. The scientists there were trying to attribute it to gravitational fields of Jupiter, but the only problem is Jupiter is far too small to induce general relativistic redshifts. And so at any rate, they didn't know what to do. So once again, they threw the date out, the baby with the bathwater, and never published it because it does not make sense in their little world. But once again, proof that the induced electric dipole redshift is valid. Now, in a laboratory, and I've done this many times for students, you take a Tesla coil. Now, there's various types of Tesla coils, but the type that I used, it looks like a cylinder, and you just plug it into the wall. It's a tuned resonance circuit, typical of a Tesla coil. And at the very top, it has a little metal cone and a point, a very sharp point at the top. And that point you can use to light up fluorescent light bulbs. There's all kinds of nifty in-laboratory experiments that you can show to students to show that you can, say, light up a neon light bulb at a distance or various other experiments. But that tip is oscillating plus and minus, I forget what it is, a couple of 100,000 volts, and at a very high frequency. And so what do you have coming off of the tip, that very fine tip of the Tesla coil? You have a oscillating non-uniform electric field. And so what happens as you shine a laser beam across the top of that pinhead that's attached to the Tesla coil? The laser beam, when there's no electricity going into the Tesla coil, of course, the laser beam goes straight. But as soon as you turn on the Tesla coil, it stretches the beam on the wall across or down the hall where you typically had the laser beam straight and it showed a little round ball. It stretched the little ball down. It didn't go upwards. Why? Because the induced electric dipole redshift always redshifts, no matter whether it's a positive voltage or a negative voltage, whether it's a positive charge or a negative charge, it's always attractive. So it only pulls the light beam down. And it's measurable, so you can actually measure the induced electric dipole redshift that's occurring in the photons as they pass over the tip. The other way you do this is you take and you can create, using a Van de Graaff generator, a high electric field that's not alternating, it's constant, and then use one of those little teacher laser beams like they use to illuminate the blackboard, put it inside the Van de Graaff generator, and let the light shine out a little pinhole. And what you see is when you turn on the Van de Graaff generator, you see the redshift. And so at any rate, this is very important science, but it's been blocked from publication for, well, go back to 1979 when this concept was invented. I actually published it in a book that was copyrighted at the time. And this is an essential part of my work on electromagnetism in outer space because it's a defined theory. It can be proven in a laboratory. Something general relativity cannot be proven in a laboratory. How do you get a black hole in your laboratory? And of course, there's scientists who believe they can simulate this, but still, there's no way to get a supermassive object in your laboratory. It probably wouldn't be a good idea if you could. But the end result is everything that you're told about the Big Bang, about general relativity, and about the related issues with dark matter, none of these things are detectable. None of them are directly measurable. You cannot get them into your laboratory. They can't even tell you the properties of dark matter. And it could all be replaced by one simple theory, the induced electric dipole redshift. And this is because of the non-uniform electric field and my understanding of the importance of the non-uniform electric field around charged objects, whether it's a nucleus of an atom, whether it's the sun, whether it's a comet nucleus, whether it's a quasar developing, a high energy new quasar. And just think, that makes quasars, they're not the farthest objects in the universe. they're sprinkled all over the place. So this is why I was talking about the blind map maker, that the measure of distance that's being used in astronomy, the redshift, is totally incorrect. It's incorrectly used. It doesn't make any sense. And now I encourage you to listen to the paid cast where I incorporate the topic of induced electric dipole redshift. But like I say, I don't have time to explain all of this deal in the all of this detail in the paid cast. So at any rate, go to the paid cast, my webpage, jmccsci.com. And this is the first week of the paid cast, part one. Last week was the introduction. This is part one of my Cosmos series, The Real Story. Just a quick mention on the webpage. I've changed the structure of my water filter prices. And so they've changed. I had to wrestle with this going back and forth, but you'll find the water filter prices are very low. You can get a stainless steel, the full-size kitchen size, with two water filter elements for under $200. Very good deal. And then the plastic is even less expensive than that. Remember, there's three offers on the sales page. If you all orders get free, the water book and the two MP3 discussions regarding water, living in a toxic world, and what you can do, what can you do is the question. But the MP3 lectures regarding water in the toxic situation we have in the world today, that's free for everybody, no matter whether you order the smallest thing, the least expensive thing, you get that free. With any orders over $100, you get free the new NASCA lines release, part one and part two. And with greater than a $300 order, you get the entire set of paid casts up to the current month for free. And so that's a really good deal. And I encourage people to check that out. Or the paid casts, of course, are $3.95 a month. And they go back to August 2016. And I think of those are, I'm very proud of that paid cast series, especially now beginning the Cosmos series. So I encourage people to go check that out. I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.